Hello, listeners. Jordan here. I just want to let you know that you can listen to Nighttime early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Include it with Prime.
You are tuned to the Nighttime Podcast, focused on the fringe of Canada.
Is a day very much like today, sunny but cool, nearly 3 years ago, when a white rented van arrived at the intersection of Yonge and Finch in North Toronto.
The driver methodically mounted the curb, then he pressed his foot to the accelerator, and what followed was a scene of indescribable horror.
And by the time it was over, the bodies of the dead and wounded were strewn for blocks along Yonge Street. 10 innocent lives brutally taken during the worst mass murder in this city's history.
Tonight, justice is finally served to the Toronto van attack killer.
Alec Manassian was found guilty on all counts.
So it was quite a scene here outside 361 University while this verdict was delivered virtually on YouTube. Many of the victims gathered here today to watch and be there for each other, support one another.
It's not closure, and it's not, like, I'm not happy, I don't feel like dancing, but I feel like justice has been done. I think it was a fair decision, and he can spend the rest of his life in jail because he deserves it.
Randy, we're back for part three of a series that we've been covering together. It's 3 years now, right?
3 years, yeah.
April 28th, 2018.
Yeah. I believe we did part two in sometime in 2019, around the time that the confession tape came up.
Oh yes, that's right. I completely forgot about that.
Yeah.
Because so much has happened in the interim. But you've been out of Toronto for a while. But when you were last there, what's left of this crime in the city? Is there still any trace of it?
Well, I mean, on the one-year anniversary, people from my work went and laid flowers for the memorial because it was in my work neighborhood, as I've mentioned, just down the street. And then the second anniversary, there wasn't anything going on because of COVID, right? A very small memorial. And, you know, it's just... now it's just the news coverage, and now the verdict has come out today, right? That trial wasn't well covered. I don't find.
I've seen quite a bit, but I'm looking for it. But I think right now, where it's not like a big load of press can show up in a courtroom and take it all in and stuff. And then there's probably also only like local reporters can cover it. Although Toronto would be probably the home to most national news broadcasters, but it's just like anything. When a crime or this horrific thing first happens, everybody wants to know about it. It's news all around the world, but almost like every day that passes, it's a little less in the forefront. And that's why, like, I find the news sites now, they're really good at like reporting the basics of breaking news, but I don't find them great at following up in really like unfolding and unpacking like a really big story. This is an example of it, but I also think like what's going on in here in Nova Scotia with the Rampage, it was, again, it's like Canada's worst act of mass murder in Nova Scotia. Yeah. And it's the press for largely has just kind of moved on, which is kind of, I don't know. It's strange, but I get it because they're playing into what people want to see and what they'll click on and what ads will run for. And generally that's like the current breaking topical stories. But what about physically though, in Toronto? Like if I was to walk down the streets where this happened, do you think there's any signs of it left, or would that all be cleaned up?
Well, completely? That would have all been cleaned up by now. I mean, I'd spoken of like the bus shelters being demolished and, you know, park benches on the side of the road and, you know, I'd spoken of that.
Yeah, I remember when we did that originally. But it, when we first recorded originally, we did it not long after the crime happened. So there was still like damage. But what I found, like the biggest difference for me was when I was in Toronto with you, like maybe last year, certain like areas where there was high traffic, they would have like concrete dividers dividing the streets from the sidewalks.
Yeah. Yeah, if there's events and stuff outside or whatever, they're going to have that.
But that's new. Like, that's because when I was there, I remember seeing it being like, whoa, yeah. Like, I know why that's there.
Or they'd have like a big truck, you know, in front of people, right? To like just put it there, like a fire truck or something to prevent people from.
Yeah, what a strange, like, what a sad state of the world that's necessary. Yeah,
I can't even believe it, man.
But. The end is nigh, because now we have the trial just finished. Well, as far as the verdict delivery, we still have the sentencing to go. But we've really seen this story play out from the initial reporting, the confession tape, which was like his police interrogation, which we did the episode of. And that was just completely shocking to listen to.
Yeah. But
a lot of stuff has come out in the trial as well that over the last weeks, basically, that filled in a lot of the blanks. I don't know how closely you followed it. Were you following the trial closely, or did you just kind of watch the sentencing?
Yeah, I just heard the sentencing basically this morning. I've been off CP24. I've been mostly watching CNN lately.
Yeah, okay. I followed it not like minute by minute, play by play, but pretty much every day. After whatever happened, I'd read like an article that summarized the day's notes. A lot of it was kind of like monotonous procedural stuff, just like any high profile trial. But overall, the totality of it all was interesting. So we won't bother recapping the crime just because people who are listening to this either know it or will go back and hear the prior first and second part we did, but he ended up being charged with 10 counts of murder, 16 counts of attempted murder, all as a result of his, what the press and what most people will call the Toronto van attack. He basically rented a rider van and drove it down. You describe the area because you work there. How would you describe the area that he did this?
So this is the area called downtown North York. So it's
or is it uptown? I got an email from someone saying you said downtown, but it's actually uptown. I'm from a city where we don't have a downtown and uptown.
No, so it's uptown as far as Toronto as a whole, right? But there, Toronto is made up of like six former cities, right? One of those cities is North York, right? So that's where it happened, North York, Toronto. Right.
Okay.
So this would be the downtown part of North York, right?
Okay.
There's businesses there. There's bank offices there. There's government offices there. So there's residential neighborhoods right in the mix. There's condos. There's malls. It's just a mishmash of everything. And there's the 401 highway is just right there, right? So this guy started at Yonge and Finch, I believe. And that's the Korean part of town. Like, he headed south. And, yeah, he went all the way down to just south of Shepherd.
Yeah, hitting people indiscriminately.
Yeah. Permanently on the sidewalk.
Yeah. Do you the video of it, there's so much like kind of surveillance videos. It's like a horror movie. It doesn't even look real. It's so shocking to see
right.
like a moving van driving down a sidewalk and to see the people. Like you can almost see people look be like, what is this guy doing? And then jump out of the way and stuff. But a lot of people were just completely caught off guard. But in the end, 10 counts of murder he was charged with, 16 attempted murder. The trial ultimately hung on whether or not, like, he admitted to doing it, of course. We heard the interrogation and did an episode of it where he fully admits it. Everyone knows he admits it and took accountability for it. But his defense was ultimately that he should be found not criminally responsible. So the controversial NCR defense, which our grandparents would have called it the insanity defense or something, which nowadays we would go by not criminally responsible. But that was what made what was interesting is his defense claimed that due to his ASD, like autism spectrum disorder, that was what led him to be not able to understand the, you know,
the gravity,
of what I did. This is an interesting thing. I what I did was I read through the judge's decision, but I also read through a lot of the statements that were made by the prosecution and the defense during the trial. So I have one clip or one quote that I'm going to read to you. And this was Manassian's defense attorney in their closing arguments, basically summarizing their position on his mental competency. So what they say in their closing arguments is that the 28-year-old's disorder, which is autism spectrum disorder, left him without the ability to develop empathy. And ultimately, he was unable to know what he did, that what he did was morally wrong. To be able to make a rational choice, you have to have a general awareness of the key facts that go into that rational decision, and the key facts have to include some sense of the degree of impact you're having on other people. Alec Manassian had no idea how horrific his actions were to the victims, their family, his family, and the community. Autism spectrum disorder played a key role in Manassian's decision to commit the attack and distorted his way of thinking, similar to a type of psychosis.
Bullshit.
Well, I think the judge would agree with you, but ultimately that was the defense. But what I didn't know, and I hadn't realized this, but to plead or to successfully get NCR, there has to be like a mental defect or a mental illness that led to, you know, the crime happening and you not being, you know, able to make the decisions or whatnot. I didn't realize that autism spectrum disorder was never actually used in the NCR defense. This is the first time that it was used to the point that the judge had to make a decision of whether or not that they would allow ASD to be considered like a mental defect.
So they set a precedent.
This is a precedent setting case.
Oh, wow.
So in what the precedent is the judge made the ruling by looking at, you know, how the NCR defense is defined and the history of it, and then looking at how autism spectrum disorder manifests in people's minds, and ultimately made the decision to say, like, yes, autism spectrum disorder could be considered one of the, like, a mental illness or a mental defect or whatever that could lead to this. Although that's not to say that the judge saw it in the defense's way, but it did set a precedent that in the future people could use with autism spectrum disorder could plead NCR as a result of having autism spectrum disorder, which I think is interesting because that's come up in past episodes I've done. I'm thinking specifically of the episodes about Lindsay Suvanaroth, who, when I did the episodes about her, she didn't sound empathetic or sorry for anybody. Also, she never said she had autism spectrum disorder, but I did read quite a bit of research that either hinted at or alluded to some diagnosis. But anyway, it's just like it's an interesting position and an interesting precedent to be set. Although I saw comments in the news about members of the autism community felt strongly that this was a bad thing. Yep. But I wonder what harm it would do. I think if anything, it would allow someone who is, like, I get that it's a spectrum, that illness, but I'm sure there are people very far into the spectrum that, you know, maybe this could benefit them for something. But I don't know.
Right. But there's a lot of people that are, you know, kind of, you know, off to the right, maybe, who would just generalize everyone who has autism capable of doing this kind of thing, and I think that's the concern.
Yeah, I read some of the judge's decision, and the judge made it very clear that they weren't equating autism spectrum disorder with criminality in any way, but just basically saying like it affects the way you think, and there's no debate about that. Is it?
Yeah.
It can help influence and affect the way you think and act.
The judge decided that Manassian having autism was not enough of a factor to deem him not criminally responsible in the van attack. But the worry here is that her decision to even consider the possibility has set a Canadian precedent by considering autism a mental disorder under the criminal code. Here's what Manassian's lawyer had to say today.
I think there are legal rulings within this decision that are very significant. And I like to think that they're significant in a good way, because I think that we're at a place where we need to start thinking about NCR verdicts perhaps differently, less conservatively than we have in the past.
Now, because of the decision, the doors have been opened to be able to use the argument of autism as a mental disorder when it comes to future criminal cases. Although the judge said today's verdict does not say anything about the connection between autism spectrum disorder and criminality, she also rules that autism is a mental disorder by the criminal code's definition because it has an impact on brain functioning and thought processes, something that concerns many who have ASD, including those at Autism Canada.
The idea that autism removes the ability to know right from wrong is just patently false and has no basis in reality. And here in 2021, we shouldn't be forwarding such notions.
And Autism Canada also adds, while hearing a judge say ASD might dispel criminality was tough to hear, Farah, they also say this creates an opportunity to hold thoughtful conversations moving forward.
In the trial, they got into a lot of his history, Manassian's history, right, with autism, with obsessive behavior, and things that would, I guess, go to show that maybe his behavior was influenced by his autism. I didn't realize that he was obsessed with mass murder. We know that his crime was motivated by, if you want to call it, the incel ideology or whatever. We know that was one of the motivations for his crime, but apparently he was like hyper-focused, is the way his defense described it, super into this website that tracked mass murders from around the world and ranked them like based on like how many people they killed and shown what weapons they used and all this stuff.
Sure.
And apparently he was like obsessed with that.
Oh, wow.
And of course we know Elliot Rogers, who came up in this story, who was also a incel-motivated murderer in the U.S., they made a connection to this website, Elliot Rogers being on it, and Alec Manassian encountering Elliot Rogers through this website and becoming, for whatever reason, obsessed with him, Elliot Roger, and obsessed with his manifesto. So it seems like, at first, like when I heard of this crime, I was like, wow, this guy got radicalized in the incel movement and did this, or incel ideology, or subculture. But I'm starting now to think it's more he got obsessed with mass murder and just for whatever clung to Elliot Rodger. Like even in this trial, they talked about in high school, Alec Manassian apparently had serious thoughts about committing a school shooting.
Oh, wow.
And didn't do it. But later on in life went on years later to do this. So this was like kind of like, it seems like it was this brooding thing within him to commit mass violence. But what's interesting is, so do you remember, you'll probably recall in our earlier episodes about this story, we talked about Alec Manassian, or however you say his last name.
Manassian.
Saying that he had spoke to Elliot Rodger online.
I remember us talking about that, but we thought that he might have been like just BSing.
Yeah, well, it turns out through the trial, like some of the people who presented testimony during his trial were different kind of like therapists and mental health workers who were sent in to basically get a read on who he was, what he was about, and if he was fit to stand trial and all these sorts of things. But apparently one thing that came out of it was he had a habit of making up these lies that were proven false very easily. One was that he had connected with Elliot Rodgers beforehand. They proved that to be false. Okay. But another one was when Alec Manassian was explaining why he hated women and identified with the incel movement. He told this story on multiple occasions about going to a Halloween party and making, like coming on to a girl, I guess. Yeah. And she wasn't interested and ended up going with some other guy, and that like made him mad. And he saw that as this kind of pivotal moment, that led him to feel this way. Yeah. His Alec Manassian's father said, no, never happened. He wouldn't have been at, I'd remember if he was at a party, he wasn't there. Okay. And what it turned out is this was an experience that Elliot Rodgers wrote about in his manifesto that Alec Manassian kind of took on as his own origin story.
Wow.
That's pretty, it's like, for me, that just, I don't know. It makes the whole thing is kind of changing the more I learn about this guy.
Yeah. Wow. That man.
Yeah, and another thing that we learned that we should just, before we get into the judge's decision and how that went down, one of the parts of this story that we've talked about and kind of speculated on and tried to explain is before Alec Manassian went on his killing spree, he went on Facebook and wrote that weird message announcing what he's going to do.
I read,
They managed to ask him about that, and he basically decoded the message and he explained what it meant and why he wrote it. So I'll explain it. So what he wrote on Facebook right before he went on the killing spree, Alec Manassian wrote, "Private Manassian, or Private Recruit Manassian, Infantry 00010, wishing to speak to Sergeant 4chan, please, C23249161. The incel rebellion has already begun. We will overthrow all the Chads and Stacys. All hail the Supreme Gentleman, Elliot Rodger." So
I remember reading that on the part one of this trilogy.
Yeah, so we explained kind of the basics. So he refers to himself as like Private Recruit Manassian. He wants to speak to Sergeant 4chan. 4chan is a website, message board that he was using all the time. He says the incel rebellion has already begun. And for anyone who's listened to these episodes, know the incels are the people who identify as involuntarily celibate, meaning they can't get women to sleep with them. They're celibate involuntarily. We will overthrow all Chads and Stacys. Stacys are kind of the women of the world, and Chads are the undeserving guys that get to sleep with those women, much to the chagrin of the incels. Then he ends with "All hail Supreme Gentleman Elliot Rodger." Elliot Rodger is another mass murderer that Alec Manassian was interested in. So we get the idea of that message, and we understand what he was saying in terms of the words, but we've never heard him describe it. He did describe it to one of his therapists. I'll read you a quote. When they asked Alec Manassian why he chose this message, why he sent this out, and this is paraphrased quotes, why he did it. He says, "I wanted something simple that was easy to say, a catchphrase. Bear in mind, I was expecting to die and that the media was going to pick up on this. The most important words in that post were 4chan, incel, and Elliot Rodger. Because 4chan gives you an identity. It says that I'm with them. Incel, because it indicates that I'm complaining about being a virgin. And Elliot Rodgers, well, I'm basically using his name to boost my name. It's kind of like working at a company and your boss is really famous. Some people might brag about working for him just to boost their fame." So, what do you think of that?
I think it's terrible. He sucks.
He, it's terrible because it's real. Like, it's, yeah, it's like if you wanted to write a bizarre, scary story, yeah, let's say I'm really into horror movies from the 70s and 80s, and oftentimes they're like slashers where the villain is just this person who snaps and is on a killing spree, yeah, or they have some paranormal power that's making them, yeah, go out and kill.
Right.
Often the writers of those movies will have to come up with like the killer's motivation.
Mm-hmm.
When you think of Alec Manassian, it's too bizarre for like a movie. It wouldn't fit for even like a supernatural horror movie. It'd just be like, it's so absurd and out there. Yet, crazy, outside of the office that my best friend works in, this guy drove a van down, yeah, the sidewalk. Yeah. And it's just, yeah, that's just the part of the whole thing that just boggles my mind. In, yeah, Canada, this day and age, the internet managed to, you know, I think there's no question he was radicalized. That's how I would describe it.
Yeah.
But
it's something out of a horror movie, like you said.
Yeah, it certainly is. It's like Kubrick, Stanley Kubrick, if he was alive today, he could do a good version of this, I think. Let's get into the trial, and yeah, not the trial, but like the decision and the verdict.
Sure. So this was a trial by judge?
Yes.
Not a jury, yeah?
No, it was a trial by judge, and the verdict was shown publicly in a very unprecedented but very modern way. Is the judge, I don't think she was in a courtroom. It looked like she was in her living room, and she was on YouTube, okay, giving her decision.
Right.
You on watched this? YouTube? Yeah, I watched it on YouTube.
Like, were they on Zoom or that was actually, like,
it looked like they were broadcasting like a Zoom kind of thing.
Okay. Got it.
You must have saw the thing that was the viral video like a few weeks ago of the judge and the lawyers in the States, and one of them like accidentally turned on the cat face filter.
No.
Okay. It was like during this isn't the Alec Manassian trial, but yeah, during some trial in the States, it's like the judge is one panel of like the Zoom window and the other two are like the two lawyers. And one of the lawyers must have like hit a button and it put on the cat filter. So his face is like a cat's face. And the judge is saying like, I think you may have a, you know, something enabled there. And the judge who, or the defense, the lawyer who had the cat face thing, he couldn't figure out how to get it off. So you even hear him say like, I'm prepared to go forward if we have to go forward like this. And he was going to continue the event like that. But luckily they seemed to help him explain. I think they explained it to him and he managed to fix it. But anyway, the Alec Manassian decision was made this morning. The judge's decision, I think, made a lot of people happy. The judge did not believe he was not criminally responsible. The judge found him guilty of all 16 attempted murder and 10 counts of murder.
Yeah.
And I think the judge in their decision, she was, as they always are, like their decisions are often so well written and so great. I thought this judge did an amazing job of summarizing her decision-making process to actually consider him criminally responsible. But ultimately, to summarize it, is when you look at this crime and the steps he took to avoid someone stopping him, and the steps he took to kill the most people possible, the amount of planning that went into it, it's not a spontaneous action of a madman. It's a long, deliberate act of someone who knew what they were doing was wrong, knew it was going to kill people, knew it was illegal, knew that someone would stop him if he let people know. He initially, and he said statements like, I feel like I accomplished my mission. He told one of his therapists, who asked him about, when people Google your name, you know, all this is going to come up. Like when people Google mass murder, your name's going to come up. And he said, and they asked, how does that make you feel? And he said, it makes me feel happy. And that was one of his motivations, was for the notoriety. In fact, the judge seemed to question if the incel ideology was even a motivating factor, or right. if it was instead a, as someone in the chat put it, a toxic LARP. You know what a LARP is, right? LARP is a, L-A-R-P is like live action roleplay.
Right.
A toxic LARP, meaning like, it's just like kind of a role he was playing. Maybe that helped motivate him to do this act of mass murder that he seemed to want to do long before the incel term was even coined. Because, you know, this started with him years prior. But one thing that seemed obvious is that he wanted a sense of notoriety. He wanted, initially his plan was to kill 100 people, was what he wanted to do. He wanted to set the world record. And he had planned to do it in a different area. I haven't heard where that was, but I can only assume it's right downtown Toronto.
Downtown? Like, I guess he must have been heading for the 401 or something after, because he was close to there.
Yeah, but I'm just thinking, like, the main part of Toronto, like, where I go when I'm in Toronto, there's so much more people.
Oh, yeah. That would have been disastrous.
But that's, maybe that was what he was trying to do. But regardless, his plan was to get the world record, 100 people. Since notoriety was a part of his motivation, the judge had made the decision that during her sentencing, she referred to him as John Doe. She didn't use his name.
She wouldn't give his name,
What did you think of that?
Good. Fuck him. He doesn't deserve what he wanted. Like, you know, this hits very close to home for me, because I could have been murdered that day. Like, if I maybe was on a late lunch or something, right? So,
yeah,
I don't want him glorified with his name out there.
Yeah, I just, I get the idea and I appreciate it. I just, I thought, like, if that was I don't know enough of the legal ins and outs, but couldn't the judge have just made it like the kind of trial that people can't see? Like, you know how there's like certain trials that you just don't even hear about because there's like court orders to not broadcast or share information?
Yeah, court orders.
Yeah, could they not have done something like that? I just feel like this was kind of strange. Like, I think of a court and the judge as this really like methodical, almost like robotic, logical ordering of information. And you know, so a part of me was like, is there not like a procedural way to do that rather than like a personal, like kind of statement sort of? That was my vibe. Although I understand why the judge did that. But it's like, I think it was kind of, it was a statement of, more so a statement of why the judge did it rather than the being an effective action. Like, for example, on YouTube, when I watched it, like the judge was saying John Doe when referring to Manassian, but down the bottom of the screen, it said like, you know, whatever versus Manassian, and every so often his, you know, so it's, but I do get it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's how it was at the Nova Scotia shooter. They didn't use his name, right?
Yeah, that was it. That was the media, though, which is different than the legal system.
Okay, yeah, yeah, true.
Like, the media decided to not use the shooter's name, at least in the beginning, but that seems to change now. You see his name all over the place. But let me read you, this is a bit longer of a quote, but I think this is the best way to summarize the judge's decision. What I did was I chose, it's like four paragraphs where she really just breaks down why she feels he's criminally responsible. She says, and she refers to him as Mr. Doe in her decision. So I'll read it verbatim. So she says, in this case, Mr. Doe knew it was illegally wrong to kill people. He also knew that his plan to run down and kill people constituted first-degree murder, and that if arrested, he would go to jail for the rest of his life. That is why his plan was to die by cop, death being preferable to jail. Mr. Doe knew that the vast majority of people in society would find an act of mass murder to be morally wrong. However, he desperately wanted to achieve fame and notoriety, believing even negative attention for his actions would be better than to live in obscurity. He'd been fantasizing about a crime such as this for over a decade. He had no direct wish to commit suicide and would not have done so independent of these offenses. However, he believed himself to be a failure, saw no hope in his life in the future, and did not care if he died, as long as he died while achieving fame. He considered the impact it would have on his family and deliberately set those thoughts aside, ignoring them, because he did not want them to deter him from achieving this important goal. He was capable of understanding the impact it would have on his victims. He knew death would be irreversible. He knew their families would grieve. And at various times during his assessments by various experts, he described his actions as being devastating, despicable, shocking, morally terrible, a horrible thing, and irredeemable. Even if he only worked this out intellectually, without truly being able to fully grasp it emotionally or to have empathy, that is sufficient. It still demonstrates that he had a functioning rational brain, one that perceived the reality of what he was doing and knew it was morally wrong by society's standards. And contrary to everything he had been taught about right and wrong, he then made the choice. He chose to commit the crimes anyway, because it was what he really wanted to do. This was the exercise of free will by a rational brain capable of choosing between right and wrong. He freely chose the option that was morally wrong, knowing that the consequences would be for himself and for everyone else. It does not matter that he does not have remorse nor empathize with the victims. Lack of empathy for the suffering of victims, even an incapacity to empathize for whatever reason, does not constitute a defense under Section 16 of the Criminal Code. I therefore find that the defense has failed to establish on the balance of probabilities that Mr. Doe was incapable of knowing his actions were wrong within the meaning of Section 16 of the Criminal Code. Mr. Doe is criminally responsible for his actions. Accordingly, I find Mr. Doe guilty on all 26 counts of the indictment.
Madame Justice Anne Molloy rejected the defense argument that Alec Manassian was not criminally responsible, finding that not only did he know legally what he was doing was wrong, but also that he morally knew what he was doing was wrong, finding him guilty of 10 counts of first-degree murder and guilty of 16 counts of attempted murder. Molloy spoke to exactly what happened that day. She refused to name Manassian in her judgment, only referring to him as John Doe, saying that she was acutely aware media coverage is exactly what he sought from the start. Molloy said that while she accepted that autism spectrum disorder is a mental illness within the section of the criminal code that deals with the not criminally responsible defense, she said Manassian chose to run down innocent people that day. She said he planned the attack, showed no remorse nor empathy for his actions, and knew that his plan constituted first-degree murder, which is why his plan was to die by cop that day. She said Manassian sought fame and notoriety and had been fantasizing about a crime like this for over a decade and admitted after the mass murder, quote, "I feel like I accomplished my mission," Molloy calling it despicable and horrible.
If you ever see a judge's decision, it's like this decision, I read through most of it, it's 69 pages, and it outlines the offense, the research, the prior cases that her decision's resting on, and then it ends with a big, long written decision. I just wonder, like, does a judge just sit up at night, like, just like typing out these short books, basically? But this one, I find, like, I know it was a little long as I read it there, 'cause a few paragraphs, but I found that it really just blows the case apart. Yeah. And makes her decision obviously the correct one. But what you don't realize when you read the report, every like line of her decision references things that were developed earlier in the report. So you really see the background of every statement she's making. And I think I don't think there's any dispute. Good. He'll have his sentencing will be scheduled on March 18th is when they're going to schedule it, but it's lucky. Like, he'll at least get life. But the question now is if his life is if the 10 life sentences are going to be done consecutively or all at the same time.
Yeah, they're always done at the same time, I find.
It seems it. Especially like in this case where it was one act.
Yeah. Like
he did this one thing that killed 10 people and 16 were attempted murder. Like, I could see it being a consecutive sentence.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know what I think of that. I don't like the idea of him ever getting out.
You think he will, or is he?
Well, if he just gets one life sentence, he'll be eligible for parole in at most 25 years. And
5 years, but then, you know.
He was 21 when he did it, right?
I think he's 28, or he was 28 when he did it.
I gotta check Google. No, he was born. Okay, he was born in 92, so he's 28.
Oh, wow.
So he did it 3 years ago. So he was like 25 when he did it.
Right.
So he's 28. In 25 years, he still won't be that much older than us.
Yeah.
I like to think he'll never get out, but I have no faith whatsoever in Canadian justice system. So.
Yeah. That sucks.
Yeah.
I don't know, though. Like, you know, I put him in the same category as a Bernardo or a Picton or, you know, so.
As far as the notoriety of the crime, but yeah. As far as a perpetrator, I think Paul Bernardo seems much more, like, vicious and evil.
Yeah.
Like, Paul Bernardo, as far as I know, didn't have any kind of, like, obvious thing clouding his judgment, where yeah. Manassian seems like he may not meet the definition to be found not criminally responsible, but he seems like a bit out there,
yeah,
in obsessive and all this stuff. But yeah. I think my guess is that he'll spend a long time in a prison, hopefully his full sentence, but then we'll probably end up spending a good chunk of his life in some kind of halfway house where he's getting hopefully intense therapy, but also being monitored to make sure him and anyone he's in contact with is okay. But that's a long time away. I guess at this point we can only hope that the judge, that sentencing goes the way of the victims and the victims' families. Cause I'm sure they don't ever want to see him out again.
Yeah. No, me either.
It's an awful story though, and hopefully this is the end of it, and so like this doesn't give people ideas. But I think just maybe it's given what happened in Nova Scotia here at the Rampage. But it's like I think no matter what, there's these psychos who are looking to kill people, and they're gonna find a way to do it in an effective, efficient way. And like Alec Manassian, he's a smart, there's no question he's a smart guy. He mm-hmm. found a way that he could, for very little money, get the equipment necessary to kill a bunch of people. He planned to kill 100 people, and that's not like that could have happened very easily.
Out of reach for him.
Yeah, that was not out of reach at all. In fact, the reason he stopped killing was because someone's coffee spilt on his windshield and it affected his vision.
His vision.
So he stopped, got out of his car, or out of the van, and he was pulling out his wallet trying to get the cops to shoot him. But so you have Manassian who uses that vehicle, a Ryder truck. Let's say we have the guy in, like, was it in Las Vegas who brought a powerful, like, automatic rifle and rented a hotel room that overlooked an outdoor concert.
Yep.
We had the guy in Nova Scotia who suited up a cop car and dressed like a cop and went on a killing spree. I just think like any little change that is in reaction to one of these specific crimes, like there's just someone's going to evolve it in some other way afterwards. Like what they stopped the sale of decommissioned police cars as a result of what happened in Nova Scotia. Yeah. But that's just that one guy. you know, and maybe they change the way people can rent vans in, you know, in Toronto, but I don't know if that's the case.
They may have, I don't know.
Well, what they did do was they put like the barriers up and stuff as kind of a reaction to this sort of thing. But what did, like, if you remove the method that, if you take all the mass murderers and take away the method that they used, and you look at like what else they have in common, like maybe that's the stuff they need to target. I don't know.
Right.
Certainly it's going to, hopefully Canada doesn't rely on you and I to figure that out, but
yeah.
Maybe yeah. Canada. It's a dark story, a horrible time in Toronto's history and in Canada's history.
Yeah.
What's that?
And in my history.
You were there.
I was there, man.
It's been 3 years. You must still remember it clearly, though.
Yeah. I remember everyone running around like crazy at work, looking out the window, seeing what's happening, and then, you know, Googling it and looking it up. And
yeah, I remember you texting me. I don't remember where I was, but I remember you texting me like, this crazy thing's happening. And then I went like on my phone from your text message to like the news and seeing it. And you were sending me pictures out your office window, I think.
Pictures. I was sending you a video of like these cops walking around outside of my office building, like holding like the, like, you know, assault rifles and like just crazy shit, man. Like, that was a crazy day. I walk across that street every day, like,
yeah.
And
I feel bad for the victims and their families, but it's like, it's so senseless and stupid. And then, like, imagine you're one of the families of these victims, and you find out, you know, your parent or your kid or your wife or whatever, or your aunt was hit by a van and killed. You would be like, oh my God, what a horrific traffic accident. Then to learn the rest of the story about there's this guy and here's what an incel is. And, you know, and you learn all this stuff. It's just like, they must have just had their jaws on the floor for like weeks after, as this whole story unfolded. Cause it's just, it's so shocking and twisted. And, and it's just, it says a lot about the types of communities that can form online. Yeah. Although, like, when I read the judge's decision, it sort of painted in my mind, was he even an incel, or was that just sort of like a part of his motivation, or not motivation, but a part of his almost like excuse to do it? Like, I'm starting to feel like he just got obsessed with Elliot Rodger for whatever reason. Like, again, when I think of the episodes I did with Lindsay Suvanaroff, for whatever reason, she got obsessed with the Columbine killers and tried to emulate their story. It seems like when I'm reading about him, I'm like, is he just like the Elliot Rodger version of that?
Yeah. Probably.
Well, is there any, one other thing, is there any monument or anything on Yonge Street where this happened for the victims?
I don't think yet. Like I said, usually at Mel Lastman Square, they do a, like, you know, laying flowers or whatever on that day, but anniversary. But I don't think there is. I could be wrong.
They should do something, it seems.
I hope so.
I want to thank you for joining Randy and I in our discussion concerning the conviction of Alec Manassian, the murderer responsible for the Toronto van attack. But before we part tonight, I'm going to give some thanks. A big thanks to Randy for taking the time out from behind the slow cookers over at Cape Breton Queso to join me here. Also, a big shout out to Monty Data for contributing the music to this episode. It's a piece called Noir Tokyo. And lastly, a massive thank you to everyone who's listening to Nighttime, as without your interest and your support, Nighttime would be as pointless as it would be impossible. But with that said, keeping the show alive is and has always been an uphill battle. So if you want to help take a bit of the weight off the show's back, please subscribe to the premium feed. Not only does it make the show possible, it'll give you more of each topic than you're going to find here on the free feed as Zomatic exclusive content weekly. So for about the price of a cup of coffee, help keep the show alive by subscribing to the premium feed at patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. And with that said, let me thank the newest supporters of the show. Sarah, Chris, and Elizabeth, thank you for your generous support. And to anyone else out there who'd like to support the show but can't help financially, you can give me a huge hand by simply sharing the episodes on social media and telling your friends about what we're doing here. If you have any story ideas or if you want to give feedback on the show, you can reach me at nighttimepodcast.com/contact. You can also find me on social media. I use Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and I'm live on YouTube most Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Sunday nights at 9:15 Eastern Time. So until next time, take care of each other, hug your loved ones tight, and let me know if you see anything weird.
The decision the judge must now make is, will Alec Manassian serve this life sentence with parole ineligibility consecutively or concurrently? Because he's been found guilty of 10 counts of first-degree murder, if he served those sentences consecutively, he could be facing 250 years without parole eligibility, which would mean he would virtually die in jail. So this is the next part of this phase, but it looks like he could spend the rest of his life behind bars, which is something all these families are so relieved to hear finally after 3 years.
The Nighttime Podcast is written, hosted, and produced by Jordan Bonaparte. Copyright Jordan Bonaparte.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.